Welcome to Authors on Tour Live, a weekly podcast for people who love to hear about books from the authors themselves. My name is Darren Fote, and today we are podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore, one of the premier independent bookstores in the nation, with three locations in the Metro Denver area. You can visit www.authorsontourlive.com for a complete list of upcoming podcasts. Wait a minute, it's time to begin.
Good evening, everybody. What a nice turnout we have to welcome Ken Jennings to the Tattered Cover. We're so pleased that you're here. He is truly a legend in his own time. I mean, I don't know many people, maybe except the president. Ken was born in 1974 in Edmond, Washington, and then spent a number of years in Singapore and North Korea. Where, South Korea, sorry. Just a minor detail, okay. I would have got that one wrong, okay. And to pass the time, he watched Jeopardy on Armed Forces TV, which was not a bad idea. Then he came back to go to BYU, where he met his wife, soon-to-be wife. They now live outside of, in Washington, outside of Seattle, with their two children and their lab, which is great. So let's welcome him tonight and hear about this great book.
Thank you. The president could not be here tonight, so luckily I was able to fill in at the last moment. I have two kids, as Pat pointed out. My son is 10. My daughter is 6. And really, Alex Trebek has nothing on little kids as far as pestering you with questions goes. I mean, you know, you have to answer a lot of stuff on Jeopardy, but it's nothing compared to having little kids. They're constantly curious. They always want to know something new. It's always something you don't know. If you answer whether you're right or wrong, they will have like infinite follow-up questions. So it's tricky. And what you find out as a parent is that you really end up lying to your kids an awful lot. I mean, typically you mean well, but for whatever reason, you know, whether it's just to, you know, whether it's to be more comforting or to simplify, or because you don't know the answer and you don't want to look weak, you know, it's just like with bears or something. You can't show any weakness or they'll run right over you. Or it's the fifth question and you're sick of it. For whatever self-serving reason, often you wind up saying something that is not true. You know, you'll tell your child that we just found out, actually, this was the first year in our house where neither of the kids believed in Santa, which was very sad for me. And my daughter, the second child, the younger child, figured it out sooner than her brother did, as often happens with younger kids. And it was all the tooth fairy's fault. You know, the kids start to lose their teeth right around the time they're 5 or 6. It's right when they're not believing in Santa anymore anyway. And that's when their parents are like, oh, wait, you know, there's one more implausible fantasy figure that you need to know about that's going to bring you stuff. This one's even weirder than the other ones, weirder than the rabbit, weirder than the fat guy, you know. Here's a new one. And at that point, like, you could just see her belief just broke, you know. She, you know, like the same person who would quite happily believed in Santa and the Easter Bunny a few years earlier was like, you're the tooth fairy, right, Dad? You know, it's heartbreaking. But a lot of these lies are just because we're not well prepared. Parents are nervous about their kids. Our kids have lots of questions. We don't know the answers. You know, often instead of being like, well, I'll look it up. Give me 5 minutes. Maybe I can find this out for you. You know, we don't do the legwork. We just give it our best shot. And we're wrong. Often we err on the side of caution. That's what led me to – that's sort of what got me into writing a book about parenting cliches and the relevant misconceptions. The story that starts the book is absolutely true. I was in my parents' kitchen a couple years ago, and my son is running around the sender divider. If there's some closed path in a house, kids will like run around it for hours for some reason. And he was doing that. He was doing laps. And he, one time, suddenly he comes around the corner. He's got a Tootsie Pop. He's got a great Tootsie Pop clamped in his mouth. And I'm like, whoa, slow up. Like, what if you fell down, you know? And he was like, what? And I said, well, you if you hit your head, the lollipop stick could get like pushed up through the roof of your mouth. And like, you'd have a lollipop in your brain. And he was just fascinated. It was like, you know, he looked so happy. It was the greatest thing he'd ever heard. Really? Like, could that really happen? And I realized I didn't know. I didn't know. I didn't know why I didn't know. I didn't know why I was saying this thing that I didn't know. And so I appealed to my mom, who was right there. I was like, well, Grandma told me this when I was a kid. So, you know, so I know perfectly well not to do this. You tell him. Tell him of the thing about the Tootsie Pops. And she's like, oh, I don't know. I read that in a book when I was a kid. I read it in a Chaim Potok book when I was a kid. And my mom always told me never to do that. And I suddenly realized I had believed this firmly for decades, this thing about the dangers of Tootsie Pop sticks. And, you know, maybe it's true, maybe it's not, but it had come from my mom, who read it in a novel, you know, of all things, like, you know, a novel by a rabbi, at least, but still a novel. And I realized, you know, I had just been passing this along, and I sort of realized this is what happens with these parental nagging warnings. They're like a... like a 17-year cicada, you know, they just keep popping back up for, you know, every generation. You know, you have to repeat all these dimly remembered things from your own childhood. It's like, and oftentimes it's like a game of telephone stretching back to, I don't even know, the Middle Ages. The book goes into, you know, whether or not it's true that you should actually feed a cold and starve a fever. And it turns out that's based on the humor-based theory of medicine. Like, we all have these, like, our bodies are governed by bile and phlegm, and, you know, this is like, you know, which is before circulation was discovered. So, you know, this is an idea that started to go out during the Renaissance, basically. And yet still today we're saying, feed a cold, starve a fever, or maybe the other way around. I don't really remember. And you know, we mean well when we do this. You know, often these things are to keep our kids from something. You know, when in doubt, I'm going to forbid this, I think, you know, because that's what parents do. Famously, there is no instruction manual for parents. And I thought, well, you know, maybe there should be. You know, maybe I should write the instruction manual. So I started making a list. You know, long before I had the idea for the book, I was keeping this spreadsheet of, you know, parental cliches, like, you know, breakfast is the most important meal of the day, or you got to have your 8 glasses of water, or, you know, you got to have chicken soup if you have a cold, all these generations old sort of naggy things. And I finally thought, you know, I should answer this. You know, people think of me as authoritative for whatever reason, answering questions on a game show, I guess. It's sort of sad, but that's what passes for authority in America nowadays. Why don't I write this book? And this was the result. And I like it now. I like the sense of competence now when, you know, my son says, do I really have to, like, wear a helmet when I'm on my bike? And I say, yes, and here's why. You know, I have emergency room data for you. Because the thing is, these things are actually quite easy to research now. You know, the hard part of writing the book was making the list, coming up with 100, 120 parental nags, you know, because we remember these things very dimly. We don't have these all ready to go in our head. So for the year I was writing the book, I was constantly bugging friends and, you know, random strangers on the internet. Hey, were there any weird things that your parents used to, you know, tell you when you were a kid? And you, to this day, you still wonder if they're true. But when I finally had the list, researching them was fairly easy. You know, it turns out that, you know, a generation of kids, you know, baby boomer and Gen X and thereafter, who were raised on these myths, went to college and decided to do case control studies on them in laboratories. So if you're interested in whether or not there really is a 5-second rule for dropped food, you don't really have to, you know, you're not going it alone anymore. There are 4 or 5 good published studies on, you know, with good data on the 5-second rule. If you're curious, it is not true. If food lands on something, it's contaminated at 0 seconds. If it doesn't land on anything, it's going to be clean for, like, you know, an hour or something. So do with that information what you will. And when I, you know, and when I had all these, I sort of realized that, so I like now this idea that, you know, if my son's running with scissors, you know, and he says, is this really dangerous? I can say, well, yes, there are, I guess I should pull out the numbers here. There's a system called NEISS, the National Electronic Injury Surveillance System, that will tell you that every year 4,556 kids under 10 came to emergency rooms for scissor-related injuries. So, but on the other hand, none of them were fatal. And if you look at the numbers, there's vastly more, the vast majority of them are finger injuries. In other words, cutting with scissors is where the accidents happen, not running with scissors. Now, it might still be good advice to tell your kids not to run with scissors. I mean, for one thing, like, what are you doing with the scissors that's such an emergency, you know? Like, nobody's ever like, oh my gosh, I gotta make paper dolls. Like, now, you know? There's actually more, I was actually able to find 6 patients whose scissor injuries were buttock lacerations. So sitting on scissors, there were actually only 4 kids in that age group who reported, you know, running injuries. So apparently sitting on scissors is a third again more gangsta than like running with them, if you're interested. And when you look at the numbers, scissors are actually safer than death traps like batteries. That's almost 5,000 injuries a year. Banisters, over 9,000. Benches, over 11,000, and coins, 28,500. And what I learned from this is that we're really bad at risk management. When I say we, I mean parents, but also people in general, you know? Like, we think about the scary things that lead the 10 o'clock news. What your family needs to know about new, you know, these dangerous new plastics or whatever at the top of the hour. You know, you gotta come back after the commercial to find out how you're endangered. And so often these sorts of flashy things like this that panic parents, you know, if you look at the numbers, they're really not that dangerous. You know, parents have, if anybody here has kids, you've had nightmares about, you know, some creepo in a windowless van, you know, grabbing your kid after soccer practice or something. There's really like less than 100 of those in the United States every year. The vast majority of missing kids turn out to be runaways or like a non-custodial parent or somebody the family knows. I mean, this idea of a stranger grabbing kids, he only does it 100 times a year. I mean, he's busy, obviously. But you know, that's not as dangerous as, say, not wearing a seatbelt or, you know, going on your bike without a helmet. And yet we panic about these sort of you know, cinematic Liam Neeson movie kind of things. And, you know, without really having, A, because we don't have any data, and B, because it's, you know, it's more exciting. Whereas really, you know, it's, you know, there's probably, you know, much more dangerous things. Again, like, you know, not being careful in traffic or something, which is actually much more dangerous. I'm going to just read a short section here, just sort of give you a flavor of the book. So it's 120 of these little myths, you know, or not myths, but parental nags, you know, no coffee, it'll stunt your growth, or sugar rots your teeth, or brush your hair 100 times every night before bed, you know, these sort of various generational kinds of things. And then, you know, some actual research and then a verdict on whether or not they're true. And I really wanted them to all be up or down, either true or false. And as it turned out, a lot of them were true with an if, you know, false, but with a but, you know. It turned out that, you know, gauging the risks involved is more of an art than a science. But I gave it my best go. Like here, for example, is the God's honest truth about if you crack your knuckles, you'll get arthritis. For many years, doctors would tell patients that their mothers had been right all along. Don't pop your knuckles unless you want to develop arthritis in your hands later in life. In other words, to crack is whack. The clinical underpinning for the myth is easy to understand. Joints do tend to get creakier and noisier as they get old and arthritic. So some doctors reverse the cause and effect just to be on the safe side. If arthritis can cause joint noise, why not the other way around? It's even easier to see why a parent would endorse this myth. Knuckle popping can quickly get annoying. And moms and dads have long sought to squelch annoying little behaviors by linking them to medical threats. This is why I tell my kids that knock-knock jokes cause colon cancer. It's actually not, in fact, true. Knuckles pop, most doctors believe, because the finger joints are surrounded by a lubricating liquid called synovial fluid. When the joint is extended, the pressure in there gets lower, and gases like carbon dioxide come out of solution and form a bubble. Then the big bubble quickly collapses with an audible pop. I should have done it at the mic so you could have heard it. But x-rays have recently cracked knuckles show tinier bubbles that stick around for another 20 minutes or so before they're reabsorbed into the fluid. This is why you can't get a good crack out of the same knuckle twice in succession. There's that little, you know, refractory period, I guess Dr. Ruth might say. In recent decades, crack research teams have begun to study the arthritis connection in detail. In 1975, a UCLA professor polled nursing home residents and found no connection between poppers and arthritics. He took up the subject on behalf of his 12-year-old son, who was tired of grandma's constant warnings of rheumatism. A 1990 study on a larger sample group came to the same conclusion, with the added caveat that knuckle popping did appear to correlate with slightly lower grip strength. The seniors who cracked didn't have any more joint pain than you'd expect, but they did need more help opening pickle jars. The most thorough work in this area has come from a man named Donald Unger, a California allergist who was, he said, pestered throughout his life by his mother, several aunts, and later his mother-in-law to quit that damn cracking. Instead of knuckling under to his critics, Unger tackled the problem firsthand. He spent the next 50 years cracking the knuckles on his left hand at least twice daily, but never those on his right hand. Science. 36,000 cracks later, he finally published his study in Arthritis and Rheumatism magazine. He had developed no arthritis in either hand. For his half century of labor, Unger was awarded the 2009 Ig Nobel Prize, an honor given at Harvard every year for dubious scientific achievement. This actually came in very handy in the book, the Ig Nobel Prizes. "Mother, you were wrong," he cried at the ceremony, gazing up into the heavens. Then he left the stage, clutching the award in his grossly swollen left hand. No, just kidding. His hands are identical. So I come out against... in favor of knuckle popping. It is not dangerous. It's mostly false. There were lots of surprises for me working on the book. I found that often some of the most sensible seeming, unimpeachable things we tell our kids actually turned out to be terrible ideas. The thing about drinking 8 glasses of water a day, you'd think, well, even if it's not exactly 8, it's a good idea to stay hydrated, right? What I found was that the 8 glasses of water number comes from a misunderstanding of an old medical textbook, which recommended that about that amount of water a day, but then said in the very next sentence, and you'll get most of that from your diet. Most of the moisture we get in our food. So if you're actually, eating a normal diet in a regular climate with regular activity, and you're preemptively drinking 8 glasses of water a day, you might be in trouble. The body's thirst reflex kicks in when blood concentration goes up less than half of what you'd need to begin dehydration. In other words, you get thirsty long before you get dehydrated. And yet, if you overhydrate, There are health risks involved. You can dilute the electrolytes in your brain so much you get a little wonky, and eventually you could pass out. And people have died from this. People who like marathoners and stuff have died from drinking too much water. There's an actor named Anthony Andrews. Do you know this guy? He was like the Scarlet Pimpernel back in the 80s. If you were watching a lot of PBS back in the 80s, where are my middle-aged people at? Respected British stage actor. He was playing Henry Higgins in My Fair Lady on the West End, and he fainted one night on stage, taken to the hospital with and nearly died. He was in a coma for days because of this, and it turned out he had, the rigors of the part had led to him drinking too much water. The indefensible joke I make in the book is that the rain in Spain stayed mainly in his brain. But this is absolutely true. Drinking 8 glasses of water a day could be physically harmful. The same with don't talk to strangers. I mean, what parent could say that don't talk to strangers is bad advice? Actually, the group that puts the pictures on the milk cartons now says that's the wrong way to teach kids. There have been cases where a child has been lost and has then, panicked about, not being able to seek adult help because of the whole don't talk to strangers thing. He then hides from the people who are looking for him at the store or along the trail or whatever. A kid in a lost Boy Scout in southern Utah, almost died of exposure because of this. He was hiding from the people who were trying to help him because, oh, here come strangers. Instead, I guess the best advice now is to teach kids how to go to adults for help. Which adults do you choose? How do you, go to somebody who works for the store, find a policeman, go to a mom with other kids, teach kids how to behave responsibly in these situations. On the other hand, some of the craziest ones that I would have assumed were just superstitions turned out to be totally true. There's now a couple studies showing that chicken soup is good for a cold. It eases cold symptoms better than other hot liquids, for example. There's one more I was going to do. Totally counterintuitive. Oh, my mom always said we had to eat the crust on our bread because that's where the nutrients were. Which struck me as crazy. I mean, it's not like a piece of fruit where this peel is actually some different thing. I mean, it was all a lump of dough, and then we put it in the oven. I'm pretty sure it's all about equally nutritious, whether or not it turned brown, right? But actually, in recent years, there was a study showing that there's an antioxidant called proto-lysine, I think, that actually does appear in bread crust as it cooks. It's the chemical reaction that browns food also creates this antioxidant. So there actually is one good nutrient that's in bread crust that's not in the rest of the bread. So sometimes mom knew what she was talking about. I hope that, you know, one thing that comes out of the book, besides people being able to say, yeah, my mom didn't know what she was talking about, or, you know, parents being a little better informed with their kids, is that, you know, we see that we don't really have to worry. Parents are paranoid sometimes. We know about all the terrible things that can happen to our kids. We've never done this before. You know, we feel like we should always err on the side of caution and dot every I and cross every T. And if we have any questions whatsoever, we should forbid something. But we don't think about, you know, what might be the cost involved in raising a kid where you tell he or she they can't do anything fun because, you know, don't go barefoot outside. What if you step on a piece of glass, or you might get worms, or don't climb trees, or, you know, I don't want you walking to school. I mean, these were all things that I did when I was a kid, and now you could, you know, people have got literally had the cops show up because they let their kid walk to soccer practice. And, you know, I would hope that, so I think there are costs to raising a generation of kids that are over sheltered and over cushioned like this, and don't feel, you know, they're going to become whatever kind of adult never felt confident in any situation and was never allowed to do anything awesome. And so I hope the book helps parents find a balance as to, you know, which things actually we need to, where we need to put our foot down with our kids and where we can give them a little, I was going to say rope, but that's maybe not the right analogy here. give them a little space. How about that? My son, my 10-year-old son has read the book. He was one of the first people to read it. He read he stole one of the advanced copies once I got him from the publisher, and he read it in bed at night with his flashlight. And his mom came in and saw him reading in bed, and she's like, "You gotta turn on a light. You can't read in here in the dark." And he was like, "Nope, that's fine. It's in Dad's book. Temporary eye strain at best, possibly headache, but no. Ophthalmologists agree, no long-term damage." So now we have a son that we can't tell anything to. So maybe if you are a parent, maybe this is the kind of book you keep on the top shelf with the 50 Shades of Grey. But I hope you enjoy it. Thank you so much for coming. We have a few minutes. I can take some questions if people want to ask questions either about the book or Jeopardy or I don't know what. Does anybody have a question? Yes, sir, in the sweater.
Do you have a kryptonite? Do, trivia?
Like a trivia kryptonite, my weakness. Would I tell you if I... is this room a safe... Is this room like a 12-step group where I'm among friends, right? I think if you watched the shows, you'll know that, you know, nobody's indestructible at Jeopardy, me least of all. The question I got wrong at the end, the category was like business and industry or something like that. And even before I saw the clue, I was like, oh, this is going to be rough. And as it turned out, it was. I had noticed earlier on the show that certain categories just kept coming up. And generally, you know, the way to win on Jeopardy is to have knowledge that's, you know, a mile wide, even if it's a millimeter thick, you know, better to be broad than deep. As in so many things in life. The things that kept coming up were like country music and hockey. I saw those multiple times and I sort of realized I know nothing about country music and hockey. This is how I found that out. So basically anything with a mullet, I guess, is my trivia kryptonite. There are other, any other questions? Yes, sir. Compared to a normal, I mean, you guys are the ones sitting in a bookstore on a weeknight, so I don't know how normal this group is. I like to read very much. My parents always read to me as a kid every night before bed without fail, and we try to do that as well in our house. I do like to read very much. I tend to read fiction, though. Like, when I'm reading for pleasure, I feel like I'm not, like, one of these people who's like, ah, look at this 800-page book about World War II. Here we go, you know? I guess I haven't hit that age yet, whatever that age is. So I mostly read fiction. In the plane, I was reading the new... it's not new. It came out a year or two ago. The Library of America collection of Lovecraft stories, most of which I had not read. But that said, I would say that these people you see on Jeopardy, these people who, these know-it-alls on Jeopardy, they're not like, you know, they don't have a stack of almanacs by the toilet like you might picture. You know, these people don't cram. They're not, you know, they're not memorizing encyclopedias. They, for whatever, I guess I'm saying they when I should say we, but for whatever reason, these kind of people just seem to have the ability to just suck knowledge out of the air, and they've always been that way. They were the kid who was 5 years old being like, "Mom, guess how big the world's biggest waffle was?" Wrong. I'm sure we all know kids like that. And these kids grow up continuing to be like that. I think we're all able to remember stuff about topics that interest us. You know, you'll always see the kid in school who doesn't know his times tables, but somehow magically he knows every word, you know, on his favorite record or every stat of his favorite sports team. You know, we're all good at remembering the facts we like. And for whatever reason, these trivia people are just curious about everything. So everything sticks. They pretty much all my, so it doesn't have to be a book, you know, all my national flags come from NBC Olympic coverage, and all my knowledge of constellations come from Star Trek, and all my Norse mythology comes from Thor comics, and you know, so it doesn't have to be highbrow. Are there other in the back with the hat?
How many questions did you end up using from that thread you posted on Reddit?
Yeah, so there's a website called Reddit, which is a sort of a, you know, content sharing kind of, that makes it sound like it's a file sharing site. It's not. It's sort of a, it's a way to waste hours and hours of your day. It's just, you know, today's weird links from the internet in order of popularity. And I thought, you know, I thought it'd be a good way to accumulate, you know, to sort of crowdsource this idea of what weird things did your parents tell you that you're still wondering about today? You know, because I didn't want it to be just things my weird parents told me. I'm sure that would be very flattering to them, but not everyone else has my parents, you know, thank goodness. And so I posted this thread on Reddit, and I got just thousands of replies, people talking about the things that their parents had told them. And because, you know, the internet's international, one thing you see is that these things are very culturally specific. You know, we might think it's funny that what's an overseas example? Like, I know Russians think that if you sit on something cold, you'll go sterile. They'll tell their kids not to sit on a cold park bench because you'll be sterile, honey. And in Germany, if you sit on something cold, you can get hemorrhoids. In China, you sit on something warm, you get hemorrhoids. If something's been warmed by somebody else's butt, you can get hemorrhoids. In Korea, they're deathly afraid of going to sleep with an electric fan on. So these sort of parental cliches differ by country, but, you know, there's nothing, you know, necessarily silly about. I mean, we think it's, lots of parents think it's dangerous to go swimming right after you eat, or, you know, the poinsettia leaves are poisonous, things that no scientist has ever believed and yet have sort of spread out into the popular culture. So I got thousands of replies, actually 20 or 30 that had not yet been on my spreadsheet. So there's maybe 25 or 30 in the book that came from reddit.com. That's your plug. Any other questions? Yes, ma'am.
Are you working on more books?
Am I working on other books? Yes. I'm actually working on 3 books right now, but they're children's books. Simon & Schuster has a kids imprint, and the guy who runs it, I guess, has a be under his bonnet about these children's fact books, you know, amazing facts. You know, I used to love these when I was a kid, and apparently it's sort of a lull for them. There's not a bunch of these anymore like there apparently were when I was a kid. So he asked me if I wanted to do a series of these sort of crazy, unbelievable facts books for kids. And so, yeah, I've written one on maps and geography, and finishing one on classical mythology, and one on U.S. presidents to come, and then these will be out next year, so... give them to the 9-year-old know-it-all in your life. Thank you for letting me plug. Yes?
I think in MapPed you said that there was like a really high density of geocache locations by Denver Airport. Did you visit any of them in Denver?
Yeah, so my last book was about maps and geography and, you know, weird enthusiasts of such. And there's a chapter on geocachers, these people that use this multi-billion-dollar array of military satellites to find little hidden pieces of Tupperware in the woods. And I use, there's an illustration in the book showing this super dense area of the geocache placement out by the airport somewhere. There's a rule that geocaches have to be a minimum of 500 feet apart, 500 feet radius from any other geocache, because otherwise they just proliferate too much and it becomes meaningless. But as a result of that, people will set them out every 500 feet exactly along major highways so that people can do these, you know, speed runs where they'll spend 24 hours and get thousands, literally thousands of geocaches. And short answer, no, I did not. I came straight in from the airport, so I missed out. I've never really understood that kind of geocaching, just driving down a road, pulling over every 500 feet of a telephone pole, running out, grabbing a little pill bottle or whatever it is at the base of the pole, you know, stamping the log because you don't have time to sign. You got 900 more to go. You know, putting it back and running back in the car. That doesn't seem as fun to me as, you know, a walk in the woods or whatever. But yes, in the front row.
Are your kids like you, and do you think they'll be on Jeopardy?
My son is addicted to Jeopardy. He wants to watch Jeopardy every night without fail. And usually it's like at 7:30, which is right about, you know, usually we try to get them, you know, in their pajamas around 8. So it's the worst possible time. And also, I love Jeopardy. Don't get me wrong. I grew up watching Jeopardy, ran home every day after school to watch Jeopardy. But I have a hard time enjoying it today. I hear the music, or I hear, you know, the smooth Canadian tones of Alex Trebek, and I'll just tense up, you know, like I can be in a sports bar and somebody will turn on Jeopardy, I'll be, you know, I'm like a meerkat. Because it's just like, you know, it's just like game day, you know, the adrenaline comes back, and you know, I have post-traumatic game show stress disorder. So I am never in favor of watching Jeopardy, but often he wants to, and he's sort of a diehard. So it is not impossible that some little mini-me will someday be on Jeopardy breaking the records. Stick one more question. Okay, is this a great question to end on? It's better than all the other questions put together.
Sports bars and play trivia there. Does anybody know you're playing?
Do I play bar trivia? Somebody like emailed me last week about this tour and said, "Hey, right next to the bookstore, there's a trivia night. Why don't you come over?" I think it was not Denver. I think it was Portland. And it's always very uncomfortable for me to go to a bar trivia night. I'm really not that despite being second only to the president in fame. I'm really not that recognizable. It's been 8 years since I was on Jeopardy. Given their demographic, most of the people who watch those shows are now dead. I don't get, or here tonight. Wow, that's harsh. So I don't get bothered at the mall much, but you know, at a bar trivia night, this is an audience that's going to self-select for being Jeopardy fans, and I sort of feel like whether I won or lost, it's going to be sort of awkward either way. Possibly for them, almost certainly for me. So I sort of feel like I'm like the guy who's been like kicked out of the casino for card counting. I got to come in with a mustache and a outrageous accent or something. My first book, Brainiac, has a chapter where I play pub trivia with some friends in Boston, and they totally brought disguises. So, you know, I'm sort of hunched over in the corner with a Red Sox cap on, you know, like, I don't think that was necessary, but no, I don't get to play pub trivia as much as I would like to, I'm afraid. Listen, I'd like to thank you all for coming. I had a great time. Thanks to Tattered Cover for having me. I think I'm going to sit down here and sign books if you like. Thank you very much, everybody.
That's all for tonight's Author on Tour. I'm Darren Fote, and we have been podcasting live from the Tattered Cover Bookstore in Denver, Colorado. Stay pod tuned in the coming weeks as we podcast Authors on Tour.